Marie Manthe is an American nurse, author, and entrepreneur. She is recognized as one of the originators of primary nursing and innovative system of nursing care delivery. Marie was named a living legend of the American Academy of Nursing in 2015. At the height of her career, Marie became addicted to alcohol and started on a journey in recovery that involved a deep transformation that is now in its 43rd year. Marie helped develop the nursing peer support program in Minnesota that has helped thousands of nurses into recovery and employment. Marie's continued services include sponsoring women, serving on AA boards, and attending 5 international AA conferences. We're as pleased to welcome Marie Manthe.
Anyway, it is a great, great pleasure to be here. I've heard so much about this group, and I'm really honored to be asked to talk about women in recovery, both because it's been my experience to be a woman in recovery and to have some experiences with extraordinary... I've had some experience with extraordinary... Will you do this again if I start going down? Just let me know. I'll bring it up, okay? I've had some extraordinary experiences with women in recovery that I look forward to sharing. And also in preparation for this, I learned a great deal more, and I hope that you find it as enlightening as I do. It is my hope today to not only share with you some of the facts and some of the experiences that I've had, to give you an opportunity to share with each other, we'll do a little tiny breakout thing, some of your experiences with extraordinary women or women from whom you learned a lot. And basically, besides just becoming familiar with the issues that women face in recovery, I also want this to be an opportunity for us to honor the women who have, whose shoulders we have stood on and who have helped us to get into this room here tonight. So, having said that, I first of all started off looking at the context of women in recovery and collected some facts that I want to share with you. Women in America did not drink alcoholically in public, if they were good women, until sometime after the Prohibition. The Prohibition changed a lot of things. First of all, though, we got the vote in 1920. 1919 was the beginning of Prohibition. And Prohibition really occurred because of the women in America who were sick and tired of the impact of alcohol on their husbands. And it was the Women's Christian Temperance Society, and also some of the forerunners of AA were very instrumental in the Prohibition movement, i.e. Oxford movement and Salem Washingtonians. So we have an interesting connection down there at the very core of AA's beginning and with the whole issue of women in sobriety, I mean alcoholics, I should say. But prior to that time, women were not seen drinking anything more than perhaps a sherry with dinner, nothing but sherry, of course, and it was scandalous. So that's sort of the setting for which we're going to take a look at what happened with women as they became alcoholics and as they began to try to avail themselves of the one thing that was working to help alcoholics, namely AA. So the Flapper Girls, my mom was a Flapper Girl. The Flapper Girls were the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. This was when Prohibition was at its highest. You know, you weren't supposed to drink at all, and people were drinking like crazy, speakeasies and so on. And a lot of the, and it was also post-World War II. You know, war always changes a lot of things in society, and that little war, that war was no exception. So a lot of the things that happened in the 20s and the 30s, besides the Depression, were in fact changes in traditions and mores and norms for women in society. Women became alcoholic, developed the disease of alcoholism in the 30s, 40s, and so on, as they were drinking much more quantities. And as you know, AA started in 1935. And I'm going to trace a little bit of history now of a couple of women in the early days. Oh, before I do that, I want to say a little bit more about the context. Namely, that research has been done that has shown that women become alcoholics more quickly than men. Men oftentimes can drink, after work and for sporting events and so on, all their life, and eventually become alcoholic or even become alcoholic sooner and handle it and get away with handling it. Whereas with women, it's about 6 to 10 years, and they really need treatment. They really need help for that period of time. So it's a much more rapid thing. Another couple of points of difference between women and men is that women have a much more serious illness with heart disease, liver disease, brain disease. Our statistical death rate is much higher than male alcoholics in those areas, and a high incidence of breast cancer. Ethnically, a little fact about the ethnicity of women alcoholics: 71% are white, and 47% are either African American or Hispanic, and 37% are Asian. So that's just a little ethnical breakdown. You look in this room, and so many of the rooms where I receive my help and recovery, and we're all pretty much a high number of white women, and different than the society. But that's another example of systemic racism that we are all looking at ways to try and resolve. So I'm going to start off with Marty Mann as one example of a woman who contributed a great deal and yet has a great deal to offer us. And then we're going to take a look at Marge Reed. Some of you may know Marge Reed. She was our local person. And with Marge, we'll take a look at what was happening in the upper Midwest. Marty Mann was a patient in a psychiatric hospital in Connecticut. And by this time, she was pretty poor. Her father had been a very successful Marshall Field, not a salesman, he was an owner of one of the executives of Marshall Field. And so she had a very comfortable life. She traveled to London. She dressed well. She was well educated. She married well, but it didn't last very long. And she ended up not knowing what was wrong with her. She insisted in that last year of her sobriety that she was crazy. She just said, "I'm crazy. I need to be treated for being crazy." Her psychiatrist said, "I've tested you. You're not crazy." He said, "I don't know what's wrong with you, but you're not crazy." And she kept insisting she was, because every time she got a break, a weekend off or a time away from the psychiatric hospital, she'd end up getting drunk, and nobody could figure out why. Her psychiatrist was one of the psychiatrists that got one of those first 100 copies of the big book. 100 copies were made, and the people who was the little group of people who were working with Bill to write it and distribute it and so on, gave it to priests or ministers, religious people, and psychiatrists. And they wanted to see if there was anything in there that would be a fatal flaw, that would turn those professions completely away from AA. And so this was like a test market, and her psychiatrist got one of those copies, and he gave it to her to read. And apparently she became sort of enraged at first when she was reading it. She said something about the print turning red. But then she became really grateful, because it named what was wrong with her. She had never heard the word alcoholic in her life. And as she learned what that word meant and alcoholism, she really understood that that was her, that she had that. Now she knew what it was, and she found out where Bill W. lived and where the first meeting was. Her first meeting was, and she went to a first meeting at Bill and Lois's apartment, and he was her sponsor. So I sponsor a lot of people, and Marty Mann is my sponsor. She sponsored me a couple of years in New Haven. So I always tell them they got good lineage, Anyway, she and Bill got along very well, and Lois was her good, was her very best friend. Marty Mann. Started the treatment center, started an alcoholism treatment center in the psychiatric hospital that I was admitted to for the alcoholism program in 1978. And in the introduction, Trish said that I had a good job and that my career came to a halt at that time. I'm going to just back up and tell you a little bit of my story to highlight some of the reasons why Marty Mann is a person that we can certainly look to for guidance and her wisdom. I came from a family. My nuclear family was not at all prone to alcoholism. My mom and dad and sister and I, we didn't have any problem with alcohol in the growing up period of time. My folks drank socially, and my mother was 100% Irish. My dad was 100% German. There were no real alcoholism except in cousins on my father's side. But on my mother's side, there was alcoholism in her brothers and her father. So all the boys in her family became alcoholic, and she and her sisters and her mother all had ulcers. So I don't know what the connection is, but the women had ulcers, the men became really skid row alcoholics. And my mother was concerned about my sister and I. She felt it was important for us to learn how to drink at home so that we wouldn't get caught with alcoholism out in the bars, you know? People thought it was contagious. I know Kathy's a nurse, maybe other nurses in here. I'm a history nut about nursing too. And I've collected all kinds of wonderful things, including a list of diseases and charges that public health nurses in Iowa, some little town in Iowa, were recommended to charge, and it gave smallpox vaccination $3 a day, and all the different diseases, you know, where they would be called in and listed. How did it say it again? It said alcoholism, $5 a day, or something like that, where alcoholism was something you could catch, and that's what it was considered. Anyway. My mother didn't want us to be caught. And so my sister and I both were encouraged to drink at home at the age of 13. And my sister was 4 years older than I. She drank at home at 14, became drunk. And my mom said, that's good. Now you know what that's all about. And she would give us guidance, too, like don't mix rum and whiskey and all that kind of stuff. 13 years old, I'm encouraged to drink. I'm given the job, if I wanted to take it, as bartender for the New Year's Eve party. And I took it, and I drank, and I added more booze to my drinks than to the other drinks, and I got sick. And the room spun around, and the family said, yay, now you know what that feels like. And, you know, it was a way in which it worked, because from 13 to 35, I drank socially, and I didn't have any craving. I didn't feel that feeling I hear so often people talk about, where suddenly everything snaps into place, and you feel like you're a whole person again. That didn't happen to me at any point in time. When I started drinking alcoholically, it was because I was in some extremely severe pressure in my life, and I had no idea what self-care meant. So by this time, I was happily married. I had two small children. I had a big-time job at the university where I was involved in that project that led to primary nursing, as Trish mentioned. It was a big project, and I could see the tremendous impact that this new system would have for hospitals and patients all over the world. So I was in a state of, you know, inner excitement about my work. And then I'd come home, and I had a 5-year-old and a 1-year-old, and they both needed a mother. And I was completely empty inside. I don't know, those of you who are moms and have come home to kids who've needed you, if you had that sense of, I ain't got nothing left. And it was that every day. And dinner needed to be cooked, and it was just a really hard time. And I found that a martini when I got home. This was the 60s. This was 68. They watched Mad Men. Yeah, that was it. And that was me too. And I had my martini when I got home from work. And I crossed over those invisible lines that I can see so clearly now I went from use to abuse to addiction over the next 10 years, 68 to 78. And the thing about the invisible lines is once you cross them, you can never go back. And so I went from one drink before dinner to two drinks before dinner. And then when I did two, I never went back to one. And I never, for a long time, I didn't drink after dinner. And one night I had a drink after dinner. And so by the time this all unraveled, I had become the chief nurse at United Hospitals in St. Paul. That was Miller and St. Luke's. And I was appointed chief nurse there. And then Yale came and recruited me. Oh, and I got a divorce along that time. I got a divorce. My husband decided he didn't want to be married and have kids anymore. So then I was recruited to go to Yale. But there's a little interlude I just have to talk about here. Although in a lot of my AA stories, I sort of skip over this just because it's kind of a bit of a distraction. Here at Miller Hospital, I had some really close companions, some close colleagues, people I loved to work with. And they did an intervention on me in the chapel one day. And they had been to an intervention class, and they had learned how to do it, and they were so darn good at it. You know, they said, you know, your drinking worries us, and we want you to stop. You have to get some help. I said, I don't need any help. I can stop any time. And they said, well, we don't think you can. I said, I'm telling you I can. I was doing this through clenched teeth. I was really upset. I can stop. I'm telling you, I can stop. Well, they wouldn't give up, and they told me they wouldn't work with me anymore unless I would get some help. And so I got an evaluation over at Wilder. She said, I'm a terminal alcoholic, and I need treatment. So I reluctantly agreed to go to one meeting a week because I'm such a busy person, that's all I can afford. I have sponsors who say this to me now, just stop. I picked the Monday night women's meeting at Richfield Bloomington, RBA. I don't know if anybody, I think they still have the Monday night meeting. And I didn't like it at all. I didn't like it at all. I didn't identify with those women. They were mostly housewives who drank by themselves during the day, and I didn't get that. And they, when they got scared, they went to the doctor, and the doctor gave them tranks. And then they took the tranks and the alcohol, and they ended up in ICUs. And I'm just thinking, this is nothing I can identify with. But there was one little lady. This was the Biltmore, and the one little lady sitting on the couch, about this tall. She had curly hair. I remember her because she made sense. She said things that were wise. I don't remember what she said. I don't remember. I just knew, she's got it. So off I go, stopped drinking for 6 months. Off I go to Yale. And the CEO, during one of the recruitment visits there, says, I'm having a big cocktail party for you tonight, and I'm inviting all the chiefs and all the my deck. And I hope you like martinis as much as I do. See, I hadn't had one for 6 months, so I was convinced I wasn't really an alcoholic. I stopped without DTs. I stopped without any seizures. I stopped that. So I had convinced myself, see, this proves that I'm not really an alcoholic. So when he said that, I said, you bet. And that night I had a martini or two. And by the time I moved in, I remember that I had a bottle of gin in my sleeping bag because our furniture came the day after we did. So we slept one the first night in using sleeping bags in the den floor. And I remember thinking, I wonder if this means I am an alcoholic. Well, over the next 3 years, the proof was in the pudding. Yes, and I drank to blackout or pass out, but usually blackout every single night. Every single night. I could not drink. And I watched myself deteriorate. I watched myself become bloated. I watched myself become depressed. And I continued to argue in my head, no, I'm not really an alcoholic, but I just have to have, I mean, anybody with a job like mine deserves a drink when they get home. I know everybody I work with drinks. And I was the administrator on call every fifth night. And that meant I would be in blackout when the call would come. Now, fortunately, in blackout, you still have judgment. Your brain does not stop being able to function, but you just can't remember anything. And that was a terror in my life. the terror was walking into work in the morning and seeing a doctor waiting for me outside my office door and saying to me, about that call last night, Marie. I had nothing. So I tried to figure out how to get him to talk about it so I could. Anyway, it was a terrible time, and it proceeded until it was stopped. It was stopped at a dinner on June 26, 1978, by my chief medical officer and my chief executive officer, two good buddies of mine. They said if I didn't go into treatment, I would lose my job. And I said outpatient. They said inpatient. I said outpatient. I don't have somebody to take care of the kids. They said, if you don't go inpatient, you're going to lose your job. So I went inpatient, and I was fired while I was in. So I was fired from the job while I was in treatment. And that was an incredible crushing blow. And I went into treatment, it was called a place called Silver Hill in Connecticut. And it was a psychiatric hospital, beautiful place. And there were 19 beds set aside for an alcoholism treatment program designed by Marty Mann. She lived near there, and she had an interest in this place, and she had designed the program. And she had retired by the time I got there, but we'd have 1 hour of consultation with her if we wanted to, volunteer. I said, oh, yeah, I'll take it. That was before I got fired. Anyway, I got fired in the fourth week, and I saw her after that. And here's why I wanted to talk about Marty Mann in particular. She gave me two guideposts that, as I was saying to somebody earlier, that, you know, in reflection, in seniorhood, as one gets older, one of the benefits of the aging process is the capacity to look back on your life in a reflective mode and see so much more than you saw at the time it was all happening, because you've got a lifetime of experience to build into that memory. And that's why it's so important for me to tell you this, get the setting of me and Marty Mann. So one of them was, she said to me, are you angry about what happened? And I said, oh yeah, I'm full of rage. And she said, what are you doing about it? I said, I don't know. My psychiatrist wants me to shove to hit pillows. But I said, I'm afraid if I won't start anything, I'm never going to stop. I'll just stay enraged the rest of my life. And she said, well, in AA, we have another day, another way, my dear. I said, what's that? And she said, we pray for them. I said, oh, okay, that sounds fine. I'm in this lovely, idyllic setting, and people are feeding me, and everything is happening, you know. And then I went home, and all hell broke loose in my life in a way that I can't even begin to describe for the next couple of years. It was a really extremely difficult time. Whoops. Let me put it down before I just drop, spill it all over the floor. Thanks, Linda. So I'm not going to go into the pain of that period of time. Fortunately, I had this project of primary nursing, and I took the time to write the book that needed to be written many years earlier, and I started building a consulting service. I started figuring out a way to make money from what I knew so I could support the kids, because I could never get another job in my field at that level. I knew that there was never going to be a job in the United States for Marie Manthe to be in any kind of an administrative responsible role. And I learned throughout the rest of my recovery in nursing exactly how true that was. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. But so the first thing she gave me was the information that in order to forgive a wrong, the AA way is to pray for them. And when I got home, she called me up to ask for a reference for her friend Priscilla, who lived with her. Now, Priscilla was the housemate, roommate, partner, life partner of Marty Mann. And they lived together in this little farmhouse in Connecticut. And Priscilla had been the Vogue magazine director, who also, incidentally, was the creator of Grapevine. So these are just phenomenal women, you know? At the time I knew her, she was out of it completely. But in that conversation, I'm jumping around just a little bit, but here's the other piece of my period of time with Marty Mann. I would drive out to the countryside where her place was, bring her in to see a Yale doctor. It was about an hour and a half each way. So I was blessed to have an hour and a half of one-to-one time with Marty Mann. And we talked about things. And one of the things I was living with in great fear about is I was writing a book. I was doing seminars. I was talking about things that nurses really wanted to hear. A lot of positive feedback from the practicing nurses in the world. And I'm learning about ego and humility. I'm so confused about the language problem between my world and the world of recovery. Ego in psych nursing and psychiatric health, ego is a good thing. Personality, strong personality, good ego strength, you know, that's great. In AA, if you have good ego strength, you're in trouble, or bad trouble. It means your spirituality is not. So I was worried about humility. How I could have humility without having an egotistical experience through my work. And here's the second thing she gave me. I asked Marty Mann, what do you do? She's written books, she's given speeches, she's traveled all over the world. How did you deal with humility? And she said, and this is what I just, so grateful. She says, I am but an instrument. I just remember when I stand up in front of people, I am but an instrument. And let me suggest that every time you're going to do something that you're nervous about, that you don't know how to be received and so on, if you think more about your service to God in that interaction, it just allows a peace to come. And I could have been really worried about this event all day today. But I reminded myself what Marty Mann taught me. So the two things are for anger, forgiveness, and we pray for them. The second one is when you're worried about your ego, you're worried about humility, just remember you are but an instrument. So one more thing, and then I'm going to move on. Marty Mann asked me to go to a meeting with her in 1980. She said, it's a very big AA meeting. I'd like you to be my companion. It's in New Orleans. And I said, oh, no, I can't do that. I haven't got the money, I haven't got the time, I can't possibly do that. Little did I know that that was the International in New Orleans in 1980. And it was July 4th weekend, and Marty Mann was the featured speaker, and she spoke, and she died July 22nd that year. And I had no idea who I was saying no to, and it's one of those things in life that it is what it is. I wish I had done that, because I then went to the next five Internationals. And I'll say something about the next one in just a minute. But then I came back here, and the first person I ran into at the first meeting I went to on Saturday night at the Biltmore was Marge Reed. And she was there. There was this little gray-haired lady sitting there with the curly hair. I walked up to her, and I said, I'll bet you don't remember me. Oh, yes, I do. You came in with James Smith or something, and I remember you. And I became a sponsee. And we've had just a marvelous relationship, and I'll tell you more about that. So my point in this announcement is, and when we get into Marge Reed, we're going to learn a little bit more about what happened in the Midwest and the way women alcoholics were treated here in this part of the country. I don't know. It wasn't this way out east. I don't think it was this way out west, but it certainly was this way in the Midwest. And Marge was a very strong pioneer in helping many, many women get into recovery. I'm watching time, and I could go on, so I'm going to really put some brakes on my comments right now. I'm going to ask you to do something, because we're looking here at women who have impacted your life. And I'd like you all to break up into threes. Just move your chair around so that you're talking in threes. And I want you to tell each other in about 2 minutes each person what women you've met, either if you don't know their name, what they did, what did they say, the wisdom of a woman in your recovery life. It was just a good idea for us to share your wisdom pieces from the women, from a woman who was in your life of recovery. And let us collect the wisdom of women in your experience. So my sponsor, my three, got sober in 1953. Pat Cronin was her sponsor. And again, I say this to my sponsors, you know. Bill W. on one side, Pat Cronin on the other side. And Pat would sometimes invite her or ask her to go to a particular town, rural area of Minnesota, and attend an AA meeting because the men there never saw an alcoholic woman. That was sort of like Pat Cronin doing his little good deed. But the reality was that in rural Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin, etc., women were not allowed to come to AA meetings in small towns. Now, the way it usually operated was the men sat around the table and the women sat around the wall. The wives sat around the wall, listening to, I don't know how that worked, listening to what the men were saying. They also made the coffee and the cookies for the men. And when a woman wanted to join, there was real reluctance to let that happen from both sides. The women were afraid because they felt that women who drank too much were generally promiscuous. In fact, they might even be prostitutes. They certainly were promiscuous, and they didn't want to have their husbands be tempted. Mm-hmm. I have this little thing that goes on in my head when I read it, and I think, I wonder if they ever took a snuck a drink in the barn. I wonder if that affected their sense of their own sexuality, and they thought, Anyway, be that as it may, women were not allowed to go to AA meetings throughout a lot of Wisconsin and so on. And Marge Reed sponsored these women by phone and in any way greeting them in any way that she could. At Founders Day each year, there was an 11 o'clock women's meeting. And the men used to give Marjorie a hard time about it. You know, how come there's a women's meeting at Founders Day for a bitch? And it was because the women were coming in just for that meeting. And this was an opportunity to talk to other women alcoholics, and it was extremely beneficial for them. So it didn't stop until 1995. I'm pretty sure that's the year Marjorie died. She died in November that year, but before that, Founders Day occurred, and they asked me to run the meeting, to run Marge's meeting. She was at Walker Methodist dying, and I did, and I spent a few minutes talking about my experience with Marge. She was just a real hoot. She had wisdom, but oh my God, her eyes sparkled. She had the mischievous joy that it was just contagious. I mean, you absolutely couldn't be down in the dumps. Because if you were too down in the dumps, you'd tell you go pray. Which she really did never. Anyway, the women took on the meeting. I gave half the meeting to the women, and it was a memorial service. It was just absolutely magnificent. So Marge Reed was 80, I think it was 82 when she died. But 3 years before she died, 3 years before that, she married a guy who'd been in the program for umpteen years. They had known each other for like 30 or 35 years in the program, Marv Spooner. He was a big character in male recovery circles here in the Twin Cities. And it was a big shock to all of us when she decided to get married, but that's not the real story. The real story is Marge sponsoring women whenever and wherever and however she was ever asked to. And she had a wisdom, a powerful way of just bringing everything down to its essence. And she was not at all above saying, go read the big book and get your answers. I mean, she would just keep people moving forward in their program. So I really enjoyed her sponsorship,
She was very much involved in service, and there's so many great women here in the community. Another thing I was going to ask you to do is, who did you know in your experience here of great women besides Marguerite? That was Carol Bean in St. Paul. She was a great woman. She helped so many people. Judy, you knew her really, really well, didn't you?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Yeah. Great woman, great service, great sponsorship, great wisdom.
Esther Hall.
Esther Hall, exactly. And that's what I was thinking of. Esther
Penny
Hall.
And Penny Boltz.
Yes.
Penny Boltz.
Esther Hall was the tradition guru. She was a tradition cop. I mean, if you were having a problem with a meeting and it was beginning to deteriorate because there was personality conflicts going on, a lot of times the group would say, we really ought to have a group conscience. And that was a very structured kind of an interview thing that someone like Esther Hall would run. And man, she would just lay it out there with no uncertain terms exactly what, how we're screwing up the traditions and what the effect is going to be if they don't get straightened out. So we have so many great women to stand on the shoulders of. And the effect of alcoholism in women today is somewhat confusing in that the fact that the book of Alcoholics Anonymous was written by men, for men, with masculine language, in some cases, in many cases, creates a dissonance that women have a hard time overcoming. My friend Gail and I always say, you know, look at the meaning of the words and don't look at the pronoun that's being used, but get at the truth that's in the book. I understand that we may be in the process now of what's the word I'm looking for?
Well, gender neutral.
Gender neutral, yeah. So rewriting the big book in gender neutral terms. So my purpose in coming today was to share with you the history of women in AA and the struggles that we had. Dr. Bob had great concerns about having women in AA. There was a woman who very much wanted to join AA, and he didn't know what to say about it. He felt that it was difficult to imagine a good woman actually becoming an alcoholic. He really thought it was just difficult to imagine. So he did what he always did when he had a problem he didn't know how to solve. He turned to God. And from God, he got the wisdom that he should turn that problem over to some of the women he trusted. So he turned the question over to Sister Ignatia and to his wife, Anne. And they found a way to bring this woman into recovery. And eventually, they were able to change the attitudes of, and she was actually the woman who, for a long time, had the longest sobriety in AA. Marty would have had it, except that she had a slip early on. So her length of sobriety was not as good as some of the other women. In the Dr. Bob story, part about this, there's an expression that they use for the men going to meetings where there were going to be women. Under every skirt, there's a slip. I thought that would sink in the way. Really. We talk about being 13 steps, and so we have overcome a great deal. And, you know, society has changed the attitude towards women, and women have changed. The amendments to the Constitution, I thought were interesting, how it was 1919, 1920, 1933, and then, you know, this is off topic, of course, but 1970, there was Roe versus Wade, and then 2022, there was another amendment. I can't remember the name of it now, but it's the one that repeals Roe versus Wade.
It's not
That's
not an amendment.
Oh, that's right. It's a Supreme Court decision. Thank you. Yeah, thank you. But it's kind of interesting to me the way the government has taken positions on women over the years. And here we go again. But I'm going to stop my remarks right now because I'm running out of steam. If I get going, I'll start another story that we won't have time for. So let's spend the next 5 minutes. Just any questions you have or comments you have?
Yeah, ginger alcoholic. I'm wondering about, you set up until 1995, women were not allowed at AA meetings here.
Well, that's when Marjorie died, but they were allowed in AA before that. It was 1953, 55. Since the early 60s, that they couldn't get into meetings in rural areas.
That makes more sense to me.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
The one.
Yeah, women were allowed in the East Coast right away. There was another woman besides Marty who was in the early days going to Bill W.'s house, which is where all the meetings were in those early years. So we are going to have a couple of them, but that's good.
Marie?
Yeah.
How is Marge received at meetings in Minnesota?
In the rural Minnesota?
When she started coming to meetings in Minnesota, how was she received?
She went to 2218 exclusively. And that was like the mother house, and that place, it was acceptable. 2218 Minneapolis, it was okay. It's the rural area. And Marv Spooner, when they got married, it was so funny. He said, and she used to be a 2218, and her little red pumps, Marjorie Spooner. And she had white gloves on, and she'd go sashaying across the collar, across the room, and all the men would be looking at cute little Marjorie. And he was just being loving towards her. But she was there, and she stayed at 2218 until 1976, I think, when she founded the Cavalier Club, which is where I go. It's an Al-Anon club in Edina now, and it's founded in a different style, a different governance than any other Al-Anon that I know of. Instead of being a club where members, individual members, belong and make pledges and contributions to its support, it's an Al-Anon club of groups. So we're down to about 20-some groups now since COVID. We lost about 5 groups. But the groups become members of the board, send representatives in to become members of the board. So there's no individuals. It's an organization of groups. And that sets and it's organized, it's operated completely according to traditions. So we follow the traditions as the way we operate the club, which is unnecessary, but it's a really good, strong thing.
Kathy Alcoholic. So, Marie, would you talk a little bit about, because what I remember Marge saying is these women are on pills, you know, because that's just when Valium the tranquilizers came on. And Marge would always be like, how are we going to get these women off these pills?
Yeah, because, like I said, they were going to their doctor because they couldn't stop drinking, and the doctors were giving them tranquilizers, and they were taking the tranks along with the alcohol. That was going on, you know, when I went to a meeting in the early 70s, and she, of course, was a believer in 12 steps abstinence. And abstinence has become a little cloudy these days. In those days, you know, abstinence, in its best sense, did not include antidepressants and tranquilizers and pills for mood changes. The best sense was we were managing with the 12 steps. And today, that 12-step abstinence has become much looser defined, and we're just adjusting to the times. So I'm not saying I like it or I don't like it. I'm just saying that's the way it is now. Mm-hmm. Abstinence is still the goal, the absence of using the substance to which we're addicted. So I'm very much in favor of 12-step abstinence. And in our peer support network, The problem with nurses, with nursing, is that the profession treats alcoholism like a moral failure. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things I stopped myself from talking about was when Marty Mann was doing her, she went across the country talking about educating the public about alcoholism, because she hadn't known anything about it. So she founded the National Council on Alcoholism for the purpose of education. That's why she founded that national organization. It became a lobbying group that is how that lobbied in order to get alcoholism defined as a disease and placed into the
DSM,
exactly. And that's why it became defined as a disease for which insurance can cover, for which money will be paid for treatment. You know, in fact, in Bonneville's time, alcoholics could not go in the hospital at all. Sister Ignatia was always breaking the rules. They were not allowing alcoholics to be patients, except that she kept sneaking in her ward, Sister Ignatia's ward. So Marty Mann went around the country, and here's the thing that just thrills my heart, no end. I was reading in preparation for this, that as she traveled, she was trying really hard to get the point across that it is not a moral failure, it is a chronic disease. And that's exactly what I am saying over and over again to any audience in the world that will listen to me. In nursing, we have to begin to break that belief. We have a deep belief that it is a moral failure. And there's a conspiracy of silence that keeps people from knowing what's happening, keeps people from getting help when they need it, and it results in our nursing having the highest suicide rate of any group in America. Statistics from 1904 to 1919 have shown that the women nurses have a higher incident rate than the male nurses do, and in general for both sexes of nurses, the connection between suicide and SUD, substance use disorder, is higher than for the rest of the population. So we are resulting in this conspiracy of silence with the horrific problem that people get in nursing when they need treatment. And the shame and the stigma is overwhelming. And that's why we started the Peer Support Network, so nurses could have an opportunity to talk to other nurses, and in that way be able to alleviate some of the shame and stigma. Peer support is the only way to get rid of shame and stigma. And it's our little nonprofit is a drop in the bucket. But we have a tremendous need, and we have a need to change our belief. It is not a moral failure, it is a chronic disease. It's exactly comparable to diabetes. You get a diagnosis, you get a treatment plan, and you follow that treatment plan the rest of your life. It's the same thing with alcoholism or addiction. You get a diagnosis, you get a treatment plan, and you follow it, and you manage your illness for the rest of your life. That's what we're doing here. We're managing our illness by being here together and sharing this. Mm. And we're doing it openly, we're doing it with joy in our hearts. I can't tell you the agony that the average nurse goes through. Hearing that she's being investigated. There's three major causes for the suicides. One, being told you're being investigated by the board. Two, being told you're fired. Three, not being able to get a job. When you're in recovery, not being able to get a job. So we have so for me, the final note here is the joy when I read that when Marty Mann was going around the country helping found the National Council on Alcoholism for educational purposes, her pitch was, it's not moral failure, it's a chronic disease. Somehow, nursing never caught on. So that's my mission, and you know, you all can help out by, you know, any nurses in your meetings. I have a phone number that anybody in the world can have, and I'll be happy to talk to anybody who's struggling with nursing, who's agonizing. If they don't want to go to the meeting, call me up. I'm happy to talk to them. And we have a website, Nursing Peer Support Network. There's all kinds of information about where the meetings are, when they are, and what some education materials are. I've produced a couple of videotapes of my own story that I'm putting out just because I can. just because so many nurses can't do that. If they ever want a job again in nursing, they can't do that. So, thank you all very much.